Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. So glad you can join me where I am every week right here on WLAW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLAW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at AnneLiguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audio Boom and iTunes. In this edition of Sports Interview, we'll break down the Open Championship, its surprising winner, and all the drama that unfolded during the second round incident involving Bryson DeChambeau. Paul Ailes, a winner on the DP World Tour, a member of Royal Birkdale, and a radio voice during the Open for RNA Open Radio Network, he will join me. Then we will shift gears to the business side of golf as it relates to investment properties with Chris Karamitsos, Senior Managing Director and Partner at Leisure Investment Properties Group, for an insightful conversation about the golf real estate investment market and the trends shaping the industry. First, the Open Championship. And at the end of this most interesting week, the Open Championship belonged to a 39-year-old from New Zealand, Ryan Fox. And boy, what a refreshingly positive story it really is. Ryan was a late bloomer all the way around. He did not turn professional until he was 25 years old. He was 30 before he started playing on the DP World Tour, and he did not earn his PGA Tour card until he was 37. And he has won 19 times overall, despite only having two top 10 finishes this season. And in this championship, in which he had cracked the top 20 only once in nine previous Open Championships, he rallied back from sitting 52nd at the halfway point. He carded a major championship record, tying 62 on Saturday, and then the 2-under 68 on Sunday, draining that birdie putt on the final hole to grab the title. Cameron Young had been waiting in the clubhouse with a 9-under. The Kiwi won his first major championship title, and the way he went about it, I thought, was equally impressive. He said he told his caddy on the 18th on Sunday, in quotes, "We're going to try to win, and I'll deal with whatever consequences happen." And what does he do? He hits what he called the two best shots in his career. Perfect timing. A drive that he blasted 330 yards and a 9-iron, 175 yards, that landed about 12 feet from the hole. He wasted no time. He plays fast. And he went up to the most important putt of his life, again wasting no time, and drained it for the win. You gotta love it. It was great to see the championship end on such an inspiring, positive note after all the negativity and backlash that Bryson DeChambeau's actions caused in the second round and the aftermath. At first glance at the footage on the par 4 fifth, I thought the footage was somewhat inconclusive, not being able to really tell where exactly the ball was in the replays and if the grass that he unintentionally stamped on was in the angle of his backswing. He hit a high lofted club there. But studying the footage, it did look like Bryson made too many steps in the area behind the ball, which definitely flattened the grass. And rule 8.1 says a player cannot improve their lie, area of intended stance of swing, line of play, or relief area. The replay shows that Bryson walked in various areas behind the ball, which definitely flattened the high grass. I don't believe he did it intentionally, and the RNA acknowledged that he inadvertently, they said, improved the area of his backswing. So they stuck to their guns. He was assessed a two-stroke penalty, and his score dropped from 7-under, one behind the leader at that point, to 5-under, three shots back. The next day, on Saturday, he went out, shot a 1-under 69. But then on Sunday, he struggled with a plus 272. He ended up finishing the championship tied for 14th. What I do not agree with is all the negative criticism directed toward Bryson DeChambeau. The fact that he threatened his agent threatened that he may not play the weekend, yes, that was a big mistake. By saying that, he caused a huge delay, and a lot of people associated with the championship were inconvenienced. They should not have said that. But I think Rory McIlroy's comments were out of line. He said he won't pretend to be up here and defend Bryson. He said, "I'm not particularly fond of him." He said he thinks a lot of it is for attention. Now, he didn't have to say that. You know, Rory agreed with the two-shot penalty, which he said he saw in real time. But all the other criticism thrown toward Bryson, that he's not particularly fond of him, really was unnecessary to say. Sounds like Ryder Cup rivalry banter, if you ask me. I don't need to know if Rory and Bryson are best of friends or not. I know they're not. There is no love lost there. And I hope the penalty would have been called on any player, regardless of who it was. I do not feel that Bryson should be maligned by the media for not talking to the media as well. Other players decline to talk to media all the time, and they don't get repeatedly pummeled for it. I assume that Bryson feels as if the entire golfing establishment is against him. He's never been an establishment kind of guy. He has always marched to the beat of his own drum, which is fine. He probably feels that because he joined LIV, and that was a mistake in my opinion, but either way, but because he is the biggest star on LIV, he probably feels that most PGA Tour players dislike him. He did say in an interview last May that he would ultimately need PGA Tour players to want him back before he'd consider a return. Again, that was Bryson's ego talking. And let's face it, Bryson loves to be loved. Bryson started the Open Championship having to deal with Nick Faldo's heavy criticism, that Nick said in quotes that he has no clue, Bryson has no clue in strategy when it comes to links golf. Obviously, those comments got a lot of attention right before Bryson even teed it up in round one of the Open Championship. I just think everybody should back off and let this guy play golf. I would like to see him eventually play on the PGA Tour. Whatever terms the PGA Tour decides to throw his way, if they even do, I hope Bryson can put his ego aside and accept those terms. I know Brooks Koepka did. He was a former LIV player, and he accepted the conditions the PGA Tour offered him. Bryson means well. Let him learn from his mistakes and do his talking on the golf course. Well, we will continue our discussion on the final major on the men's calendar when we come back. Paul Ailes will join me. Paul is a winner on the DP World Tour, a member of Royal Birkdale, and was part of the RNA Open Championship radio team this past week. We will be back shortly with my conversation with Paul Ailes. Joining me now to tell us all about it is Paul Ailes, a DP World Tour winner and member of Royal Birkdale for 13 years. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
Paul, Ryan Fox carded that record-tying 62 on Saturday, and then in the final round, he birdied four of the last six holes, including that dramatic birdie on 18 to grab the victory. Do you know anybody who picked Ryan Fox to win this?
Other than people from New Zealand that know him well, no, I wouldn't have thought so. He was kind of an outsider, but obviously shooting the 62 was, threw him right into the top end and the sharp end of the field. And to finish the way he did, wow, that was just sensational golf he played.
Where were you during the final round?
I was lucky enough, I was assigned to him with Matt Adams for the Open Radio, so I got to watch every single shot and was there on 18 when he rolled that putt in.
Well, what I love, and I read that he told his caddy that we're going to try and win and I'll deal with whatever consequences happened afterwards. And he said he hit two of the best shots of his career. Can you talk about it?
Well, 18's a particularly difficult hole. It's over 500 yards playing as a par four. The wind was off the left-hand side. You stand on the tee box and all you can see is a sea of sand. You can't see a fairway down there. And he absolutely striped it miles down, left himself, I think, around about 170 yards to go, and was either an 8-iron or a 9-iron that was just never left the flag, came up 11, 12 feet short, and the rest is history. He rolled it straight in the middle.
Yeah, he just clobbered that drive, like 330 yards right down the middle. I think he used a 9-iron from, 175 yards and made an 11-foot, 7-inch putt for birdie. And he wastes no time when he plays, right?
Sure. I think that's how he's always played. And he's working with psychologist Carl Morris. And that was one of the things I said. Just don't give you any time to think negative. You know, you're clear with it. Don't need to go into conversation with the caddy. You know what you're doing. See the shot, pull the club, play the shot. And that's exactly what we saw. I think it was somebody recorded it. I saw 22 seconds from Sam Burns picking the ball out of the hole to him actually holding out. So quite remarkable, really.
And what a great story. He's 39 years old. He did not join the DP World Tour until he was 30. And then he said he was 37 when he was a rookie on the PGA Tour, and then 39 winning a major championship. That's a pretty inspirational story.
It was obviously a long apprenticeship, and took him a while to get going, a late bloomer, as you say. But I think he tried other sports, got a rich sporting heritage, and came to golf a little bit later after trying cricket and rugby. And it just takes time, you know. He never believed that he wasn't going to play well. He just kept going and going and going. As I say, he was a huge part of the DP World Tour when he joined. Ever so popular amongst the guys on tour and all the caddies. Just, what you see on the TV is kind of how he is. There's no edge to him. He's never going to get above his station. And obviously went over to the PGA Tour. Did he win in Canada the first year or see? I don't know
Yeah, he
whether
did
he
win the
won.
Canadian Open for sure.
Yeah, so I think he's either won once or twice on PGA Tour, which was no surprise to us guys over here in Europe. We knew the power. He just hammers the golf ball as hard as he can, and with the putting touch that he displayed this week, he's got both ends of the spectrum going there, and so no surprise really.
Well, he was 52nd at the midway point. So what a comeback.
Yeah, it helps when you shoot course record 62, doesn't it, in round three? That sort of puts you in contention. And the weather was strange. The wind was so-called lay down or in the wrong direction in the morning, and then it switched to the northwesterly, which is the prevailing wind for Royal Birkdale. And that really caught one or two of the guys out. And as the statistics bore out, the 17th, a par five, was the easiest hole all week, and 18 was the toughest hole all week. So to birdie the toughest hole and the final round tells you something about the guy himself, doesn't it?
It's a great, great story. What a positive ending for an Open Championship, particularly since there was so much controversy with the Bryson DeChambeau episode.
Yeah, that was a shame, wasn't it, that he made it about himself, really. But I don't think there's any surprises in the golfing world what sort of came out there. Obviously disturbing for everybody. Guys hadn't got the tee times for the following day till gone 11 o'clock at night. So it wasn't just about him. He was disturbing an awful lot of other people with his actions there. But I suppose you probably know Bryson better than I do. We just see him over here and admire his golfing ability, but on this occasion, he didn't do himself any favors.
What is your opinion on the two-stroke penalty that he was assessed on Friday?
And I don't think there's any doubt the pictures are quite clear there. Not that I'm a rules expert, but when you've got the best rules experts in the world all talking to each other, getting these pictures were pretty damning, and they just assessed him the two shot penalty, saying it was an accidental improvement of his swing path, which it obviously was when you see he stands behind the ball. So it's not just the line of the shot going forward, it's obviously backwards. So and he could get a clear backswing at it to chop it out. So disappointing because he'd done so well on that Friday afternoon to get right up there at the top of the leaderboard. The two shots added to the scorecard obviously unsettled him, and he was never quite the same player on the weekend.
Yeah, it's too bad. I at first thought that he should have given the benefit of the doubt because it was hard to tell where his backswing was, and where the ball was with all those replays. But it was a wedge too, so he probably had more of an upright backswing. But then, as I studied the footage and listened to the rules officials, I guess it was quite clear that he. But you would have thought he would know better than to pretty much trample all that grass behind him. Are players getting careless? Was he the only one maybe targeted because the camera's following him all the time? Or are players obviously now going to be a little more careful when it comes to shots like that?
I think there's a lot of to be said that the top players obviously take the media attention and most of the cameras, but I think the way the Open Championship was televised and most of the majors, I think every single shot for every single player is televised these days. So, everybody's treated the same. He wasn't just picked upon because he made some clumsy actions, and it was, the best I would say was very clumsy where he went in there. As a professional, not to improve your lie and you tread carefully. The same would be, if any other situation, any other lie, but to go in there and stomp the long grass down behind the ball was, it was pretty clear from the rules officials what they had to do.
And Rory McIlroy was not happy. He was quoted as saying, "To hold the tournament hostage like that, and to have all of us players, volunteers, everyone waiting on him, and it was not a good look for Bryson." Do you agree?
Yeah, it wasn't really. I mean, I just saw, I came in late from the golf course and switched on the TV, and of course this was still going on because I wanted to see where where the draw and the cut was going to be, and who I was going to watch the following day, and for this to go on, and then the pictures of him coming out of the scorer's tent and then wandering to the practice ground with four baskets of golf balls. And that was, getting towards 9:30, quarter to 10 in the evening when the light was fading. That's just not fair on those people that are volunteering. And everybody else, his fellow competitors there, the draw couldn't be done until they knew he was going to be in the field.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, he practices till late at every championship. So that didn't bother me as much as them saying, his agent in particular, that he might not play the weekend. That was a mistake, I thought. One of the local favorites, the local favorite, Tommy Fleetwood, got so much attention this past week. Can you talk about the atmosphere there and how, they responded to Tommy's play?
Yeah, in the build-up, it was all about Tommy, and he's from the local town of Southport, and he's never hidden the fact that he would love to win the Open Championship, particularly in his hometown. And I was out with him for the third round, and literally he was cheered onto every green, from every green to the next tee. The applause, it's most unusual that Rory doesn't take the biggest crowds, but on this occasion, most of the following was behind Tommy's match, and I believe it was the same on Sunday. He had a standing ovation when he finished his round on Sunday, and just the joy that he brought to the hometown crowd, and then of course he handles himself so well as a professional. He's a credit to our game. And I'm sure he's inspiring an awful lot of youngsters to take up the game of golf.
That's true. He did handle the pressure just beautifully, and I'm sure he wanted it so bad, and he's wanted to win an Open Championship so bad, particularly in his hometown. But that was a thrill to watch him. And what were they talking about with Scottie Scheffler? Because Scottie hits the ball so well, tee to green, but he's had issues with putting this season.
Yeah, I watched him in round one, and again, it was just sensational. I followed him in the last round at Portrush last year, and he was picture perfect. Pretty much everywhere you want to hit the golf ball, he did it. But unfortunately, when it comes to the putting green, he doesn't put it in the hole like everybody else. I don't know where he sat. I haven't seen those stats, but I would figure he was quite a way off Ryan Fox, who would have gained an awful lot of shots on him just on the putting green. Scotty, he handles himself so well. Obviously the disappointment there is coming in as the reigning Open champion and playing nicely, as he said in all these press conferences, how well he was playing, and he just couldn't convert all that good play into lower scores. But he's still around there. I'm not sure there's any secret sauce that he can put on that putting stroke, but it has worked from time to time, but it just seems to have gone cold at the moment.
Paul, you've been a member at Royal Birkdale for 13 years. Has the weather ever been that dry and that beautiful for an entire week?
It tends to get a little bit brown in the summertime these months, but we've had a particularly hot lead up into the Open. We had a couple of weeks where we had record temperatures in the UK. That sort of burnt off some of the rough, which was okay because I think it meant that the guys weren't just chopping out sideways as we see at some venues, that they could get to the ball and advance it toward the green. So from that point of view, it was it was good. But we do see it fiery. It changes obviously as the seasons change. It gets a little softer in the autumn time, and then the winter. We're lucky that we're sand based, that we can play 12 months of the year. But I think it was just set up absolutely perfect. And of course, you hear the top players. How do you defend the golf course now for the guys that hit it so far? And they all say, well, firm greens and fast and running fairways. So I think that's what the green heads greenkeeper, Sean McClain, and his team did. They delivered. They delivered.
Do you feel that this Open reaffirmed that Royal Birkdale is one of the finest Open venues out there?
Yeah, obviously, I'm going to be a little bit biased. I do love Royal Lytham and St Annes, which is about an hour's drive north of here, where the AIG Women's Open will be in a couple of weeks' time. That's also one of my favourite courses, and I think favourite because the fairways are pretty flat. Carnoustie is another great. I mean, they're all in their own right great, but I think when you think there were 362s and 10 under par one. It's testament to the quality of the golf course that the average score for the players in the field that week was actually just over par. So, without any trickery, it was a fair test, and the weather was fine for them.
And it sounded like everybody was very positive about the changes because I know Royal Birkdale did a lot of revisions since the 2017 Open Championship.
Yeah, I think the new holes went down well, in particular the fifth hole that was had a lot of excitement there. apart from Bryson, there was a lot of balls driven onto the green, lots of twos made, eagles made, and some fives and sixes made. And in fact, Ryan Fox was ever so lucky in the final round. He hooked his tee shot and very nearly finished in a little penalty area to the left, but he had a free drop away from a temporary obstruction and made a four and moved on. That could have easily been a six on a hole that's just over 300 yards. So that was good. All the tee boxes have been changed. The bunkers, I think, were absolutely in the right positions. Tom McKenzie, that was one of the things he did with the change, was audit all the bunkers. So I think there were net 21 less than we've had previously. So fewer bunkers. So you would think it would be easier, but it hasn't turned out that way for the top players. And of course, 15, the new par three, that really challenged the players. And in practice, it's 245. They were playing it into a wind, and the RNA decided it was too tough of a challenge, so they moved the tee box well forward, just to give the guys a chance. And then, of course, the wind turned around into its normal direction, which meant that that's how the hole was designed to be played. So then the tee box went back. So the players had got every chance, and I haven't heard anything, any mumbles from any of them. And we know the condition was as good as any that's ever been on record. So, yeah, just I think that, and again, because the wind had died down, the RNA were able to speed up the greens, because on links courses they're quite exposed to the strong winds, and if you get them too quick, the danger is that balls will blow off the place where they've come to rest, which nobody wants. Then you have to stop play. But on this occasion, they got the green speeds up to 11, which is slow by PGA Tour standards. But by Open standards, they're pretty good. And of course, the quicker the putt, the more the subtlety of the breaks comes into play. And there were some really juicy pin positions out there. When I saw the pin sheets most mornings, I thought, ooh, we're in for a bit of a treat here.
And plus the bunkers, even though, as you say, they were less with the modifications. I mean, to see some of the positions that these players had to get into just to hit out of these bunkers, I mean, they're tough, very tough. A lot of deep, deep bunkers on Royal Birkdale.
Yeah, we've actually shallowed the bunkers out, but of course, for the open, some of the sand was removed and made the firmness on the base of the bunkers for the top pros. But when you do that, then of course the back edges of the bunkers are a little steeper, and if you get unlucky and finish up against one of those, as Ryan Fox did on 15, you've got a choice to make. You can come out sideways, backwards, or do whatever, but you're not going to get toward the target. But he made a great bogey four there. If you can ever make a great bogey, he certainly made one, with his calmness of thought and his skills on 15.
What a display, Ryan Fox. It was just so much fun to watch. And when you talk about Royal Birkdale and you look at the champions that have won in its history with these Open Championships, Arnold Palmer in 61, Peter Thomson twice, Lee Trevino, Johnny Miller, Tom Watson, Ian Baker Finch, Mark O'Meara, Padraig, Jordan Spieth. I mean, the names are star quality. So it must be fun to be a member there, Paul.
Well, it really is, and we were lucky that usually the champion comes into the clubhouse after he's done all his media, and we have a staircase there. All the members gather in the hallway. The champion comes down the stairs, holds a trophy up, and everybody gets a chance to take a picture. And I think years to come, Ryan Fox will come back to Birkdale, and he will be an outstanding ambassador, not only for the Open Championship, but for Royal Birkdale, as we found I Ian Baker Finch to be. Dame Laura Davies has been made an honorary member, and she keeps returning to the club. And so we're very lucky with those champions that we honor with an honorary membership, that they tend to come back and represent the golf club at the highest level.
Tell us about your week.
Yeah, it's always great fun. When you're working with great professional broadcasters, I'm just there as an analyst, somebody who knows a little bit about golf and certainly a lot about the golf course. So it was kind of easy for me, not too much research needed at the start of the week. And so you get assigned to a match in a morning, you get a little bit of time in the studio, and we flip and flop around things. And then, of course, to work alongside Maddie Adams on Sunday and following the final group was just an absolute treat. So in the evening time, we're finishing late as well, so we're getting up to 10 o'clock when we get home. So by the time you've had a little bite to eat, it's into bed, and then you're back on the at the golf club at 6:30 the next morning. So they're long days, but very rewarding, and again, you get the best seat in the house.
It sounds like you just had an incredible week. What will your next assignment be?
I'm not really sure. I sit on the board of the DP World Tour, so obviously we've got some issues and challenges coming up with players coming back from LIV potentially. What's going to happen with our schedule alongside the new one on the PGA Tour, which has been announced by Brian Rolapp. So all these things are coming along, but then the day-to-day, our top executives of DP World are very good. We are a members organization, so I shall be no doubt on the end of phone calls, emergency meetings if things need to be discussed through, and just happy to support the tour and certainly the exciting talent that's emerging all the time.
The depth of talent is extraordinary, and you have a big job. I know there's a lot going on in the world of golf with the new schedule and everything else. So continued success. Next time you come on the show, we'll have to talk about some of these new decisions that the PGA Tour has decided upon and the DP World Tour, how that all fits in. Paul, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Golf's resurgence has done more than increase participation. It has transformed golf courses into highly sought-after leisure and investment properties. From private clubs and public courses to destination resorts and golf communities, the business of golf has never been more dynamic. And joining me now is Chris Karamitsos, Senior Managing Director, Co-founder, and Partner of Leisure Investment Properties Group, one of the leading firms specializing in the sale and advisory of golf courses, marinas, and other leisure real estate. Chris is also a member of the PGA since 1995 and brings a wealth of just experience and insight from every segment of the golf industry. What a pleasure to have you on Talking Golf, Chris. Welcome to the show.
No, thank you very much, Anne. Pleasure to be here.
So first, tell us about the company, Leisure Investment Properties Group.
Yeah, it's been a great whirlwind for us. We saw a few years ago an opportunity in the real estate side of the business to bring our expertise that we have in real estate transactions to a whole nother segment of real estate, which is the leisure side. And we saw that there was a glaring need for really good kind of Wall Street investment underwriting and transactional expertise on that side. Up until that point, there really wasn't a lot out there for people who wanted to buy or sell golf courses, and they were kind of flying blind. And we saw a niche to be able to bring our expertise on both the real estate side and the golf side, marry them together, and be able to advise our clients in the best way to do that.
Sounds like a perfect job for a PGA personality like yourself.
It was great because I had a little bit of a real estate background too, because I worked for my dad's real estate office for a long time. And then, some of our partners, I got recruited by Steve to come and start the leisure division for a big national firm. And from then we just, that was back in 08, and we grew it to what it is today. We're the most active golf course and leisure advisory group and brokerage group in the country.
So, how would you describe the current market, Chris, for golf course transactions compared to, say, 5 years ago?
Great question. 5 years ago, as you remember, we were just going through COVID. There was a lot of uncertainty as to what was going to happen. We do know that when you couldn't do anything outside with all the social distancing, and the only thing you could do was get out and play golf or go boating. So both industries saw a really great resurgence, and we started recruiting more and more golfers all over the country. You had people that said, "I don't think I'd ever play golf, but it's the only way I can get out of the house and do stuff." And then what happened was, for the next 2 years, all the intelligentsia in the industry was like, "Wow, golf is doing great. Is this just a COVID bump, or is this going to last?" And so people had a wait and see approach. Looking at all the numbers and how the golf courses started performing. Hey, these are going to be great investments, but let's just take a wait and see and make sure. And sure enough, even after 3, 4 years, golf just stayed steady. It continued to grow, and the golf courses are doing better than they ever have.
So, what types of golf properties are attracting the most interest?
There's a couple of different segments of the golf product type. So everybody knows you've got private golf courses, and sometimes what they don't realize is sometimes they're owned by a group of members, sometimes they're owned by a big company. And then you've got your daily fee courses and the ones that are run by cities and municipalities. What really is popular today is private clubs that are on good solid footing are always very popular, because one of the things that you have to understand is golf is an interesting business model. It relies on a couple of things that you have no control over. One is weather, and the other is the disposable income of your patrons, right? So the only other thing you can control is what kind of a product you put out there and the customer service. So private clubs are good from the standpoint of, even if it rains, you're making money because you've got dues line. Not so much on a daily fee. So there you're a little more susceptible to those risks and challenges. But depending on where you are, like in New York, so many great private clubs, good daily fee clubs are kind of at a premium. So if you can find a really good dynamite experience in New York, somewhere where there's really a lot of private clubs and it needs to be a little more democratized to get people out on the golf course, I think you'll see daily fee clubs also become very, very popular.
So, what are buyers looking for, Chris? Investment opportunities, lifestyle assets, redevelopment potential? What are they actually looking for?
Not so much on the redevelopment side. Those are generally a little challenging to get. It happens where golf course might be better suited for as a housing community, but there's a lot of reluctancy. What they're looking for, golf investors really are looking for a couple of things. Something that's got a little bit of lift. Okay, all golf investors want to look at something that's doing okay, but has a path forward, has a little trajectory that they can capitalize on. And that's called the upside in the sizzle. So, really, the majority of the golf courses that we sell are golf courses. Most golf courses are doing fairly well financially, but there's always room to grow, it seems like. If you've got a great plan moving forward for the club, put some reinvention capital into some of the as you've seen out there at some of the courses in Long Island, I can tell you down here in Florida, in Naples, it's almost like an arms race.
Really?
Every club is just putting more and more capital into their clubs, making the amenities even better. They want their customers, their members to feel special. They want really a lot of great improvements, and that's what you're seeing now.
Because competition is so intense, I'm sure.
Very intense. It's very intense right now, but that's good. It gives the member or the would-be member a lot of options, and it makes the other clubs have to become better.
And so, is there a lot of opportunity now for your company, Leisure Investment Properties Group, or are all these other, golf properties just so immersed in making the experience so great for their members and for the golfers that they want to kind of hold on to their property?
Yeah, great question. The ownership groups usually run in a cycle. There are some that are just buy and hold, and they're going to hold forever. But most people have an exit strategy, and it doesn't matter what kind of real estate, investment real estate you look at. Anywhere between 5 and 7% of the entire inventory is going to trade on any given year, whether it's an apartment complex or a retail center. Triple net lease or a golf course or a marina. There's always going to be a percentage of that inventory that is going to trade. So, and we're ideally positioned to help facilitate that.
Well, you've mentioned, appealing to obviously the clientele, but what characteristics make a golf club especially attractive to investors?
Well, first of all, making sure that there's not too much deferred maintenance and not too much CapEx that's needed. That's important. Knowing where the water comes from and how much it costs. That's all. And I don't want to get too germane or anything, but there are certain characteristics inherent to the product type itself that can be a little challenging that investors are always going to look for. You see a lot of golf courses that were, when they were originally thought of, and I'm not talking about the classics, but stuff that came online a little bit later where they wanted to, hey, let's make it as hard as we can, and then, and now, with the whole, hey, let's tee it forward, let's dumb down the golf courses a little bit. This thing's got a gazillion bunkers. No, let's take bunkers out. Right? Because they're very expensive to maintain. I sold a golf course a few years ago that only had like 22 bunkers. The guy was loving it. He's like, I only have 22 bunkers on this golf course. This is the greatest thing I've ever bought.
I love it. So your company, Leisure Investment Properties Group, you not only deal with golf course acquisitions, but you also sell and advise marina properties. That's interesting.
Yes, we do. Marinas have also been a very good investment on the leisure side. And the other thing too, just to mention and go back, this goes for marinas as well. The returns are so much better on the leisure side than they've been on the core commercial side. And I don't want to get too into the weeds, but just basically, it costs a lot of money to borrow to buy a commercial real estate investment these days. If you recall, you hear all the talk and chatter about interest rates are high, that
Sure.
makes the cost of capital high. So what happens is it's harder to go buy an apartment complex that's going to give you a real small return when you got to pay so much money in interest than it is to go and buy a golf course or a marina that's got a big return with that same cost of capital. So now your margin is so much better. And that's one of the things that make marinas and golf courses very attractive to investors right now.
I was going to say, what are the similarities between the two? You already mentioned the ROI. Anything else?
Yep. The ROI and the fact that they cater to leisure enthusiasts. Okay, people that want to play golf. You'll find most of the golf course owners have some golf background if they weren't, they may not be golf pros themselves, but they're avid golfers for the most part. You get on occasion, you get a few guys that say, "I've never touched a golf club in my life, but I like the numbers," But and the same thing though with most of the people we know of that deal in marinas, they're all boating enthusiasts. And you get into a marina. And the other thing too is, quite frankly, it's a lot more glamorous to look at pride of ownership and come in and see a beautiful marina or a country club and show this to some of your friends. You'd rather say, "Look at my beautiful marina," than, "Hey, look at this great industrial building that I just bought that's got, a bunch of hardware and stuff." So it's a little more glamorous, and you also get the benefit of making a little more money than maybe you would.
And is that what makes a marina a strong long-term investment? Those
Yes,
particular things that you mentioned?
and the quality of income, slips are doing very well. Dry storage, when you've got a lot of dry racks that you can rent out, lease out long term. I mean, those are all good indications that the asset itself is on solid footing. And yeah, they've exceeded investors' expectations, I can tell you, over the last 4 to 5 years, ever since we came out of COVID, this leisure airspace has done tremendous, tremendous.
And what's the turnover like with both the golf properties and marinas? Because being such a healthy and strong market, right? Do people really want to sell?
Yeah, like I kind of mentioned a little bit, everybody's got some degree of exit strategy that they have in their mind. Most of the hold periods we're seeing is anywhere between 7 to 10 years. When we write out when we do a pro forma, we'll probably look at a 5-year cash flow and internal rate of return analysis, but expect that to go a little longer. And then, of course, if you're doing something that's got let's say there's development associated with it as well. So there might be a housing community associated with it that's going to build another 500 units, for instance. Well, then you're looking at a much greater hold time because you're going to be building that out, and you might be holding it for 15 years before you get the whole project completed. But usually on your just your standalone golf or marina, anywhere between 7 and 10 years.
And is it more valuable or more of an asset to have the real estate component to the golf?
In some instances, yes. What most developers like to do is if they have a golf community, for instance, and they're building out the houses, they want to maintain control of the amenity. Same thing with a marina. If it's a marina community, until you're about 80 or 90% built out, because they're using that amenity, that golf course, as an amenity to drive those lot sales, and they want that golf course to be in pristine condition. And then once, they might turn it over to the HOA, or somebody might come in and buy it and run it separately. But while they have to sell those lots, they want that amenity, that focal amenity, to be just absolutely dynamite.
And your background is, you wear so many hats. Just if you would tell my audience a little bit about, the variety in your background, from a PGA professional to serving as a lieutenant in the US Army, and how all of this has helped you in this specialized business.
Yeah, it certainly is a crazy path to get to where I am. But yeah, I started off in the Army, came right out of college, and was an Army officer for 4 years, and then got right into the golf business. So it was like, do I go to law school? Do I want to go? And I was like, you know what? I like golf. I want to play golf. I think a lot of us who are PGA professionals, when we get into the golf business, we have this idea that somehow we may be a tour player someday. And I played competitively. It didn't take me that long to figure out I wasn't going to make $1 million swinging a golf club, but maybe I could get into a different side of the golf business because I loved it so much. And so I got to learn everything about the golf business, from being a teaching pro to an assistant pro to running golf courses, being a GM. So that gave me a really good a good idea of what comprised the golf industry. And I even repped. I did some sales repping early on for putters for putter company when I first got in, and it just gave me a really good idea and background of the whole industry. And then working on the real estate side with my dad, I saw an opportunity to marry my golf experience with the real estate experience, and that was the most fun part. And the best part of the business is all the great people that you meet on all different areas of the industry. From the media people like yourself to some of the CEOs of the biggest companies that run golf. To other brokers and golf professionals. I being a golf professional, I think it's one of the things that's been most rewarding to me is how many other golf professionals I've helped get into the ownership ranks. There's almost, I'd say not every golf professional, but there's a lot of golf professionals that always say, oh boy, if I could just own my own golf course someday, that would be my dream. And I've helped make it happen for a lot of guys, and that's always been very rewarding for me.
Add mentor to your list of accomplishments for sure. So it's so
Absolutely.
obvious you're so passionate about what you do, Chris. What does it take to do your job better than anybody else?
It takes discipline. It takes a relentless pursuit of excellence, really, is what, and wanting to also mentor the next generation coming up. I mean, we have a fantastic company here, and we're bringing up a new crop of investment advisors, teaching them what's important. But you have to be disciplined. You have to have a passion for wanting to help people. Anybody who's good at anything, like doctors. Okay, the best doctors in the world are, they just want to heal people, right? And the best investment advisors want to provide the best investment advice to their clients. And that's our passion, is watching people become successful at what they want to do. And when we have a hand in that, that's really the most rewarding part of it.
I love what you said, having a relentless pursuit of excellence, because you've been doing this for a very long time and it never gets old, right? You keep it fresh, it's exciting, and there's always new opportunities on the horizon.
Always. And that it's such a crazy, saying. Everybody says, oh, if you find something you love to do, you don't work a day in your life, So that really is true. Sure, you've got tough days, but you if all you were doing were playing golf for fun, if you were retired, you could just play golf every single day, which I'd like to get there eventually, but I'm too busy right now. But even when you're doing that, you're like, oh, I had a bad day on a golf course. You're always going to have a bad day, but you're going to love it anyway. You're still going to go back out the next day. We love what we do. We started this company because we love what we do. And, everybody asks, hey, when are you going to retire? Do you think you'd like to? Like, why would I even do that? I could do this until my 80s, I think, as long as I don't lose my mind.
I know where you're coming from. I get that question all the time. And why stop when you just love what you do? You have a passion for it. Before I let you go, Chris, best day on the golf course, what would you say it was?
Well, one of my most recent best days was at your tournament, Anne. We had such a great time. I think I made more feet of putts than I ever have in my entire life,
At the
with the
Maidstone Club in East
at the
Hampton, New York.
Maidstone Club
To benefit
in
St.
New
Jude.
York.
I'm so glad you came up for that. That was so much fun.
That was so much fun. I'm very privileged to be a part of a charity that is involved in education, and we do a charity event out in Pebble Beach every year, and that's really a lot of fun. We're going to do that again in October. And then personally, I had a one year I had a really good round in a US Open qualifier at a golf course that I ended up selling later down the road, and so it got me from one stage of US Open qualifying to the next stage, but I didn't make it past that. So
Which course was that, Chris?
that was a golf course that is now Cabot Citrus Farms, as a matter of fact. And back then it was called World Woods. And
Right.
oddly enough, the year that I went from the first stage to the second stage, the Open was at Shinnecock that year when Corey Pavin won. And I was trying to get back to Long Island to go to be able to play in the U.S. Open in my own stomping grounds, but it didn't come to fruition, which was too bad. But
Well, as you know, we just had the U.S. Open out here at Shinnecock, and what a win for Wyndham Clark. And boy, I've covered five of those U.S. Opens, so I could have been there when you were playing.
You probably would have. And we have some mutual friends too that some of my best friends have worked for you in the past.
Yes, for sure. Well, there's
Great.
a lot of, synergy and that's what I love about the golf business. Everybody knows everybody else, and it's just such a great business full of wonderful, very generous people. When I host my charity golf event, all I have to do is ask a club manufacturer or, a specific golf product, and we get so many donations in, for prizes and for auction items, and people like yourself, who do so much for charity and who just have such a compelling background and position in the golf business. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris. So thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Anne. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Chris Karamitsos, Senior Managing Director, Co-founder, and Partner of Leisure Investment Properties Group. Thanks again. My thanks to Paul Ailes, to Chris Karamitsos, and to My Good Sound Production. As Plato once said, be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle. Have a great weekend. I look forward to talking with you next time right here on Sports Interview with Anne Liguori.